And welcome to Here We Stand. I am your host, Kevin Annett Eagle, Strong Voice. That was the Ballad of the Carpenter with Phil Oakes, our folk singing brother from the 60s who was murdered in 1975, but his message, as Jesus' message, lives on in all of us with the hearts and minds willing and able to bear it. This is June 21st. It's solstice. It's also Father's Day, and I want to dedicate the show to my father, Bill Annett, down there in Daytona Beach, hanging in there, almost 92 years old, writing away, writing like a demon. That's what us Annetts do. We're habitual writers and provokers. My symbol is the year of the monkey, in case you didn't know that. Cheeky monkey, the year of the cheeky monkey. Well, today is going to be kind of a thing I used to do from the pulpit in Port Alberni. I say to folks, after a while, you know, you've run out of words to say. Words don't do nothing unless they're backed up with action. So I changed my sermons into what are called dialogue sermons. I'd throw out some words and let people stand up at the pulpit and talk about anything. That's how we first began to hear the stories of the murders, the mass killings in the residential schools just a few miles down the road. Well, I'm going to try that today again. And I'm going to read a bunch of stuff. And I'd like you, as you're listening, take notes, write back to me, thecommonland@gmail.com. I was really encouraged this last while with more news pouring in all over the continent of people taking the step that we've been prodding them to take for over 5 years and actually forming common law assemblies. There's three more this past week. I'm not going to say where, but if you want to learn more about that, write to republicofcanada@gmail.com and follow our show and all our work, murderbydecree.com. You can see all our books there. We're going to be reading from some of those books today, and I guess you could call this show a fireside chat on Canada, the common law, and fighting tyranny with laughter, because that's one of the few weapons we have, folks. Anyway, let me start with a personal account of something. It's taken from my book called The Caucasian Healing Fund, 1497 and so on, A History of White People in Canada. I couldn't help but use that title. The Caucasian Healing Fund, after the federal government set up what they glibly called the Aboriginal Healing Fund. You see, that's how we deal with genocide, folks. We heal the people we killed with a bit of money and words. So I think this title is more appropriately called the Caucasian Healing Fund, since all of those efforts were really about healing white guilt and legal liability. But anyway, on with the story. When I was 5 years old, this is the story. But my dad and I called him looking for them. My dad tells a story of how I disappeared one day when I was only 5 years old. It turns out I wasn't lost at all. I was searching for someone. It happened at that bit of down-home chintzy hype Canadians call the Calgary Stampede. For you uninformed folks, that's where cowboys and other real men abound and prove they have balls by trying to lose them literally, by riding on the horns of pissed-off Brahma bulls for tons of idiotic and fat-applauding tourists. Well, the rodeo shit didn't interest me much that year we attended, even though my brother Bill and I were decked out like latter-day Hopalong Cassidys in our chaps and spurs and cardboard cowboy hats. Too innocent to feel ridiculous as I strutted around trying to look like Wyatt Earp, I remember being profoundly disappointed at not seeing any real live Indians at the Stampede. All the brown-skinned folks there were dressed just like me and all the redneck noise and the standard cowpuncher shit. Man, I wanted feather bonnets and tomahawks and bloody scalps hanging from their belts. So anyway, as quick as you can spit tobacco, I vanished into the crowd as Dad, who was supposed to be watching me, was off smoking somewhere. Well, he and my mom spent a number of what I'd like to hope were panic-filled moments searching for their cute and irreplaceable wee Kev and coming up empty. Dad says they were about to sound the general alarm and bring in the Mounties, like, yeah, that would have helped, when he spied my cute little butt in my unmistakable cowboy chaps sticking up in the air outside some tourist Indian's teepee. The top part of me was inside. Dad grabbed one of my legs and hauled me out into the light of day, giving me his make-believe pissed-off look he only donned when Mom was around. My father demanded of me, "What the hell were you doing in there, Kev?" And I lisped back at him, "I was looking for them real Indians." Well, as a matter of fact, I still am. And that's a whole story in itself, isn't it? I mean, you can follow more of that story at murderbydecree.com. But leading from that, I want to tell you about some real live Indians I've known, and it's taken from another one of my books. Again, you can get all these, just go to murderbydecree.com and go down, and you'll see them. A book called Fallen, The Story of the Vancouver Four. And those were Harry Wilson, Ricky LaValle, William Coombs, and Bingo Dawson, all of them murdered on the streets of Vancouver in St. Paul's Hospital in the case of William, because they were confronting the Anglican, Catholic, and United Churches over the mass murder of children that they personally witnessed. And let me just do this reading from chapter 3. Start with a quote from a guy who helped found British Columbia in the year 1868, Sir Edward Bulwer Lytton, colonial secretary. The town of Lytton is named after him. He said, "Colonization is civilization. If we, the superior race, take the land of these savages, we must utterly destroy them, the previous inhabitants. I may have to employ the Colorado solution and order every white man to kill every Indian in this province." Unquote. That's here in lovely Canada. And my friend Delmar Johnny, who was a Cowichan elder in mid-Vancouver Island, before he died, he made the remark, "When I see my people coming out of the superstore every day crammed with coke and chips and all that shit, I see the genocide worked on us because it's never stopped. It's a big soul-sucking machine that's eating up everybody." Well, that's kind of appropriate today, I think, in this crazy climate we're in right now. But let me just share something with you in this account that you may not have heard about before, again, involving our lovely Canada. It always struck just before dawn. A sharp whistle, the shouts of gruff voices in the foreign English tongue, and the plague would descend. It went after the children, and it spared none of them. We just sat on the beach for days and cried for our children, a very old Nechanef woman told me once. None of them ever came back to us. Many of those disappeared children ended up in special hospitals whose existence will always remain hidden from Canadians. In the post-war World War II years, when military research money was flowing in torrents, the doctors in those dank places normally had the cover of Canadian Air Force officers. This could explain their continual use of wartime aviation terms when referring to their little brown test subjects. Over coffee, or when chowing down at the base cafeteria, the doctors would revert to their native German tongue and joke about the virgin targets that had just been delivered from the local Indian residential schools or from Catholic orphanages. Perhaps their use of the expression was part of their adoption by the culture that had given them sanctuary after the war. For in the early months of 1945, Allied heavy bombers had annihilated in an hour many of their pristine hometowns in Germany that had been previously unscathed. Oberstleutnant Otto Rainer, one of the SS doctors who came to Canada under Project Paperclip and went by the codename Major Bob Armstrong, had his own reason for using the expression. He wanted payback for his barbecued kin. By 1953, when he was safely ensconced as a Canadian citizen, Rainer always requested of his RCMP handlers that Jewish children, as well as Negroes and Indians, be delivered to his laboratory at the Lincoln Park Air Force Base just outside Calgary. His sacred oath, after all, had been taken for life. Dr. Rainer became a popular figure in medical circles and in the United Church hospitals where so many Indian children like Harry Wilson were held. Rainer became especially close to the RCMP officers who provided him with the backup required by his AAA security status, sanctioned by the Canadian Army and their colleagues in the Pentagon. And in the process, the SS doctor came to know a young policeman named Peter Montague, and other members of a secret cult society that met at the prestigious Vancouver Club at certain nights of the year, and still does. Peter Montague, by the way, folks, was one of the RCMP people who headed the smear campaign against me and our movement that started in the summer of 1998. The church provided Aboriginal children in Rainer's cages. These children were useful in many ways, including at the Vancouver Club, but his primary interest was experimental. After Rainer dissected and gutted them as he would a batch of gerbils, the Indian children fascinated Otto Rainer. In his research notes, he observed that the Aboriginals possessed a quality missing in other children, what he called a vital presence, that allowed them to live longer with their minds intact. This trade encouraged the doctor to expand his research to engulf an ever-increasing number of Aboriginal children provided by the ever-obliging Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches. And so as the 1960s dawned, Rayner commenced his own fishing expeditions beyond Alberta to find the perfect test subjects from among the large pool of captive West Coast Indian residential school children. He'd focused his experiments on uncovering and capturing that quality which, at least in his thinking, would allow a final absolute control over humanity. Beginning to sound familiar, folks? Rayner's utilitarian Canadian and Yankee colleagues do not share his quasi-mystical views concerning soul and energy captivation, but they did appreciate how completely his methods wiped clean and refashioned the human mind. And his experimental results had more than a military application, as my four native friends discovered. Billy Coombs and Harry Wilson had exhibited the vitality so sought after by Otto Rayner and his team, for unbeknownst to the boys themselves, they were descendants of shamanistic bloodlines. The two of them ended up quickly in the special section of the R.W. Large United Church Hospital in Bella Bella, British Columbia, where they became guinea pigs in Rayner's use of psychopharmacological drugs to turn people into unthinking robots. Rayner had two colleagues, two other whitewashed Nazis called Dr. Heinz Lehmann and Dr. Ruth Kyander, who settled at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay. Both of these doctors had pioneered the clinical drug known as chlorpromazine. It's often called the chemical lobotomizer because of its creation of a state of mental disinterest without a loss of consciousness. Touted as a cure for schizophrenia, chlorpromazine actually wipes out critical reasoning and the capacity to act on one's convictions. And just a side note on that, I keep wondering in meetings and conversations I have with people these days why they don't seem able to do anything. They can only talk, but they can't act on what they believe. It wasn't like that way 10, 20, 30 years ago when we hold meetings. People had become mentally immobilized. And I think chlorpromazine has something to do with it. Because in its earlier form, known as Largactyl, the drug was inserted into the drinking water of prisons and Indian residential schools to reduce the inmates to a state of mental docility and compliance. But while the effects of Largactyl tended to wear off after a day or two, chlorpromazine's impact is permanent. And one of the consequences of the drug is to engender infertility, especially among males. Well, isn't that a perfect solution for the elites? A mind-controlling drug that creates a populace of cattle-like slaves unable to question or breed. Can there be a better solution to overpopulation and social upheaval in the minds of the wealthy elites, whose overriding fear concerns their own future? Expunged from my own culture and immersed in the lives of the four and their kind, I encountered some of the human remains of Rayner's experiments. The mosaic I built from their accounts, that you can read at murderbydecree.com, revealed something far more heinous than any of us besides the victims could have imagined, a thing that has wrapped its coils around everything we once knew as normal. Just look around. In the words of somebody who seems to know, Dr. Michael Persinger of Laurentian University, he wrote these words in 2009. Within the last two decades, a potential has emerged to influence directly the major portion of the 6 billion brains of the human species without mediation through classical sensory modalities. How? By generating neural information within a physical or electronic medium within which all members of the species are immersed. Unquote. An electronic medium in which we're all immersed. Well, folks, I've learned to turn off the internet. So moving right along on that note, and I always say to folks, like, do not think that this is some kind of downer because you have to know the sickness to come up with a cure. So on a lighter note, back to the Caucasian Healing Fund book. Now Justin Trudeau, sorry, I meant Trudeau, but actually the name in English translation of Trudeau is Waterhole. We used to call his dad Pisshole, actually, or otherwise known as the Trudeau. Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau saddled on us in the 1970s and some of the 80s, but he brought in something that I think his son Justin is trying to imitate. It was called the War Measures Act. Around about 1970, some of the wealthy Westmount crowd in Montreal got panicky because the nationalist Péquistes, the Parti Québécois, and René Lévesque began climbing in the polls. And they asked the boys in red to do something about them, and fast. So voila, that same year, a convenient and tiny band of armed mercenaries appeared, sprinkled with paid provocateurs from the RCMP, and they called themselves the FLQ, the Front pour la Libération du Québec. They showed up out of nowhere, just like a lot of fabricated government creations, and they kidnapped a Quebec cabinet minister, Pierre Laporte, and a British trade diplomat named James Cross. Well, things got out of hand quickly, which happens with contrived scenarios. Somebody shot Pierre Laporte through his head and stuffed him in the trunk of a car. Of course, the guy had strong Montreal underworld connections, but of course that was never mentioned by the media or anybody else. And then, after Laporte's execution, a well-crafted hell broke loose. Well, enter just then that paragon of liberal mythology, the Turdo, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, a Jesuit-educated snob and kiddie molester. Pierre promptly called out the troops, literally, arrested without due process lots of Canadians, and trashed all those bleeding-heart liberals who worry about such silly things as civil liberties and a fair trial. Well, go ahead and bleed, Pierre admonished them on the public airwaves with his usual aristocratic sneer. Welcome to the War Measures Act. Of course, unlike his son, he relied on legislation done order in council to justify his tyranny. Justin's just acting all on his own. No parliament, no courts, no Emergency Powers Act at all. Things degenerate, folks, don't they? Anyway, Pierre Trudeau had a real sexual identity problem, and not just involving underage boys. He used to beat up his sweet wife, Margaret, in public. That's Justin's mother. Including one day at the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa when, over dinner, he didn't like a comment Margaret made and slammed his fist right into her face, out cold on the floor. Well, this was witnessed by my own uncle, George McCuitt, who is a Liberal Party bagman, and witnessed the whole thing with a typically Canadian embarrassed silence. I guess Jolly Pierre had to keep proving what a real man he was. He had sat out World War II, like the pampered rich boy he was. And so, bingo, in came the Canadian Army, and out went civil liberties and the rule of law, faster than Pierre could say, look at my big dick, just to deal with 12 FLQ guys and 4 undercover Mountie cops carrying pop guns. Hundreds of us got arrested and jailed without trial during the fall of 1970, and not just in Quebec. That particular reign of state terror went on for many weeks, and just like now, nobody really seemed to mind. But the whole mess, of course, like now, did have its funny side. Since the Mounties were involved. The boys in red, not known for their artistic sensibilities or mental dexterity, once gathered up a subversive suspect's entire collection of art books on Cubism because, you know, Cuba. Cubism. Duh. Well, that's the RCMP for you. Their top officials are now getting sued by their own female officers for sexual harassment and on-the-job rape. So go figure. Anyway, it all goes to show you that Canada isn't necessarily the most boring place on earth. And now Pierre Trudeau's debonair son, Justin, is our prime minister. Well, not mine, of course, but anybody believes in this fiction called Canada, I guess you could call him yours. Why? Because he's got a last name and called Trudeau, and he's got a cute profile. What? Dynastic successions here in Canada? Mais non, tabernacle. Well, we've got about 7 minutes to the bottom of the hour. Then I'm going to play another comical relief from our friend George Carlin. He's going to talk about germs, and I think that's quite appropriate. Next few minutes, though, I want to read a couple of more things. A little piece of historical anecdote you may not know about. Americans keep asking all the time, how can you celebrate Queen Victoria's birthday? Well, I don't, but people in Canada have this sentimental attachment. The other day, somebody even said that, well, she was our last constitutional monarch. And I said, yeah, but monarchs aren't constitutional. One rule by anybody is not based in anything but tyranny. But anyway, let's talk about Queen Victoria, who is actually history's biggest and most successful drug dealer. No, not our Vicky. I can hear all of you royalty-loving Canucks whimper. Yes, bozos, your Vicky. One of the least popular British monarchs in history, incidentally, who underwent at least 6 assassination attempts by various of her not-so-loyal subjects. She wasn't the nicest person in the world, if you recall her public comments about her own children, whom she referred to as, quote, little nasty objects, often to their faces. But that's not her worst crime, despite how all those love-deprived, screwed-up kids of hers went on to sire the crowned heads of Europe who launched the war that didn't end any war in 1914. Abused children will do that sort of thing to each other. Of course, they didn't do it to each other, but all the cannon fodder who obeyed them for some reason. Well, no, Vicky's real claim to fame was opium. Incredibly, the British-sponsored Chinese opium trade accounted for about one-third of the total revenue pouring into the British Empire during the mid-19th century. And so Queen Vicky launched two wars, called the Opium Wars, against those heathen yellow people for having the temerity to try to curtail the opium addiction that was killing off their people and fueling the coffers of the British monarch. At one point, a big chunk of the Royal Navy was dispatched to shell Chinese coastal villages and wipe out any cheeky Chinese who tried to defend their nation's sovereignty. As one British admiral noted at the time, quote, the Wogs, that's the Chinese, seem oddly reluctant to bow before historical inevitability and the superior strain of our noble race. And as for Victoria, folks, well, at the end of the day, Vicky ended up killing about 100,000 or more people just so she could rake in mega profits and wander her estates in the Highlands in the company of various he-men studs. I guess that's why we still celebrate Victoria Day all across Canada, right? Well, wrong. We're not going to do it anymore because in the Republic of Canada, we'll have abolished all that stuff. And I'll talk about that a bit later. We are going to take a short break now and listen to George Carlin, and I'll be back right after that.
It's just one more way of reducing your liberty and reminding you that they can fuck with you anytime they want, as long as you put up with it. As long as you put up with it. Which means, of course, anytime they want. Because that's what Americans do now. They're always willing to trade away a little of their freedom in exchange for the feeling, the illusion of security. What we have now is a completely neurotic population obsessed with security and safety and crime and drugs and cleanliness and hygiene and germs. There's another thing, germs. Where did this sudden fear of germs come from? In this country, have you noticed this? The media constantly running stories about all the latest infections, salmonella, E. coli, hantavirus, bird flu, and Americans are, they panic easily, so now everybody's running around scrubbing this and spraying that and overcooking their food and repeatedly washing their hands, trying to avoid all contact with germs. It's ridiculous, and it goes to ridiculous lengths. In prisons, before they give you a lethal injection, they swab your arm with alcohol. It's true. It's true. It's true. Well, they don't want you to get an infection. And you can see their point. Wouldn't want some guy to go to hell and be sick. It would take a lot of the sportsmanship out of the whole execution. Fear of germs. Why, these fucking pussies. You can't even get a decent hamburger anymore. They cook the shit out of everything now because everybody's afraid of food poisoning. Hey, where's your sense of adventure? Take a fucking chance, will you? You know how many people die in this country from food poisoning every year? 9,000. That's all. It's a minor risk. Take a fucking chance, bunch of goddamn pussies. Besides, what do you think you have an immune system for? It's for killing germs. But it needs practice. It needs germs to practice on. So listen. If you kill all the germs around you and live a completely sterile life, then when germs do come along, you're not going to be prepared. And never mind ordinary germs. What are you going to do when some super virus comes along that turns your vital organs into liquid shit? I'll tell you what you're going to do. You're going to get sick, you're going to die, and you're going to deserve it because you're fucking weak and you got a fucking weak immune system. Now, God damn it. Hey. All right. Let me tell you a true story about immunization, okay? When I was a little boy in New York City in the 1940s, we swam in the Hudson River, and it was filled with raw sewage, okay? We swam in raw sewage, you know, to cool off. And at that time, the big fear was polio. Thousands of kids died from polio every year. But you know something? In my neighborhood, no one ever got polio. No one, ever. You know why? Because we swam in raw sewage. It strengthened our immune systems. The polio never had a prayer. We were tempered in raw shit. So personally, I never take any special precautions against germs. I don't shy away from people who sneeze and cough. I don't wipe off the telephone. I don't cover the toilet seat. And if I drop food on the floor, I pick it up and eat it. I eat it. Yes, I do. Even if I'm at a sidewalk cafe in Calcutta, the poor section, on New Year's morning during a soccer riot. And you know something? In spite of all that so-called risky behavior, I never get infections. I don't get them. I don't get colds. I don't get flu. I don't get headaches. I don't get upset stomachs. And you know why? Because I got a good, strong immune system, and it gets a lot of practice. My immune system is equipped with the biological equivalent of fully automatic military assault rifles with night vision and laser scopes. And we have recently acquired phosphorus grenades, cluster bombs, and anti-personnel fragmentation mines. So, when my white blood cells are on patrol, reconnoitering my bloodstream, seeking out strangers and other undesirables, if they see any suspicious-looking germs of any kind, they don't fuck around. They whip out the weapons, they wax the motherfucker, and deposit the unlucky fellow directly into my colon. Into my colon. There's no nonsense. There's no Miranda warning. There's none of that three strikes and you're out shit. First defense, bam, into the colon you go. And speaking of my colon, I want you to know I don't automatically wash my hands every time I go to the bathroom, okay? Can you deal with that? Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. You know when I wash my hands? When I shit on them. That's the only time. And you know how often that happens? Tops, 2-3 times a week. Tops. Maybe a little more frequently over the holidays, you know what I mean? And I'll tell you something else, my well-scrubbed friends. You don't always need a shower every day. Did you know that? It's overkill. Unless you work out or work outdoors or for some reason come in intimate contact with huge amounts of filth and garbage every day, you don't always need a shower. All you really need to do is to wash the 4 key areas. Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. Got that? Armpits, asshole, crotch, and teeth. In fact, you can save yourself a whole lot of time if you simply use the same brush on all 4 areas. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
There was another one I was going to run, actually, for my dad especially. He does a brilliant one on death, and really great. I'll play that next week, maybe. Anyway, his comment about germs is really appropriate because it has a spiritual and personal dimension as well. You know, the idea that we don't stay well by avoiding the bad stuff. We engage with the bad stuff and develop immunities and antibodies to them. We don't avoid anything, including our enemies. We don't avoid dangerous situations. We don't avoid evil. We engage with it, and that's how we grow. I mean, compare yourself now to the way you were years ago. Was that because you were sitting in a cave somewhere? No, it's because you engage with the world, and you change, and you develop all sorts of mental and spiritual and emotional antibodies, right? That's called human evolution. We evolve in our own life, too, folks. So don't be afraid. Engage. The best people I've ever experienced have been my own enemies because they help me grow. Think dialectically. Yin-yang, right? Okay. In that sense, before I get on to talking about some really important stuff about how to deal with adversaries, I'm going to do another reading. I just can't resist. It's called another final bit from Caucasian Healing Fund called Locking Up the Queen, etc. As I write this, Lizzie Britt is thinking of stepping down as the monarch she claims to be, which means she'll be history, possibly, by the time you read this, just like the former Pope Joe Ratzinger, the kitty killer, is. We knocked out both of them. And they're stepping down to avoid arrest. My great-great-great-grandfather, Philip Annett, who shouldered his musket in Canada to snipe at Tories in the monarchy back in 1837, must be laughing his celestial butt off right about now. And maybe he's especially giddy, even for a Baptist, knowing that his great-great-great-grandson had a hand in Lizzie Britt's deposing. Actually, I can't take ultimate credit for her fall, although I will. The royal twit brought it on herself after snatching those 10 forever missing Indian kids from the Kamloops Residential School on October 10, 1964, in front of eyewitnesses. I guess she figured she'd get away with it. But that's the kind of woolly thinking that comes from imperial breeding. What? Her royal idleness was served an arrest warrant early in 2013 after word of her late-night fun at the Kamloops School reached our European Common Law Court of Justice. Now, that reason, folks, is why she's stepping down, not because of some idiot called King John, who's now wanting to take the crown, the fictitious crown. No, that's a cover story to the fact that she's stepping down as a direct result of things that we, the people, did. Rulers can't have people think they have power, remember? Anyway, the delightful thing for me is that the latest opinion poll of Canadians say that well over half of us want to dump the British monarchy once and for all. So it looks like a final curtain is calling on the Union Jack, or as my Irish relatives call it, the butcher's apron. The much-needed imperial demise has no doubt been assisted by all of this agitation recently for the Republic of Canada. And that's a good thing. And that's up to all of us to carry on. So, moving right along, this is an important book. It's called, one of the books I had the most fun writing, actually. It's called Truth Teller's Shield, a manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers. And it's kind of gleaned from my own experience, which, of course, is our best teacher. Summarize your own experience all the time. That's what we need to be doing, not just talking in the abstract about stuff. And this is taken from chapter 3 in the book called Knowing Your Adversary. This is very important. Like I say, engaging with evil, not avoiding it. Start with a quote from Sun Tzu in The Art of War. And for a lot of you who are listening, who are part of the effort to establish people's assemblies, this is a very important thing to grasp because it's not a debating society. We're going to be engaging and taking back our society. And that means at some point coming into conflict because, as Sun Tzu says, there's only two constants in the universe. That's conflict and change. So don't run from conflict. Embrace it. That's how we build up the antibodies. Knowing the enemy and knowing yourself in every battle, you'll have no danger. Not knowing the enemy and knowing yourself, one defeat for every victory. Not knowing the enemy and not knowing yourself in every battle, certain defeat. And he also said, true knowledge of the enemy comes only from active contact with him. Again, our point about antibodies. I call it evil is real, specific, and has an address. People and institutions of the lie. A Russian saying goes that everyone reacts differently to a tickle, but always the same way to a hot burning iron. Evil is like that. We all may have our own different idea of what evil is in the abstract, but when face to face with it, we all know evil for exactly what it is, an intentional, hideous, undeterred force of corruption and destruction, especially on the innocent. Evil is familiar to us. Evil is very familiar to us because being so commonplace in our world, we've acclimatized ourselves to it. That existential fact is a constant problem for a truth teller or any activist. For the cruel injustices and sufferings that give you so many sleepless nights do not disturb the mass of humanity, especially since the rulers and laws expect them to live alongside evil and uphold it. Now, if evil was just a purely individual phenomena, as the exorcism genre films always teach us and would have us believe, then dealing with it would be straightforward. You simply exorcise a demon out of some poor, helpless kid or drive a stake through Dracula's heart. Well, things are not so simple because the Dracula is a whole society, whole institutions. Unfortunately, evil is intrinsic to creation of mankind and therefore embodies itself within institutions and entire cultures as civilization evolves into ever-increasing complexity and violence. And the ideal system for evil to dwell within and prosper is the corporation. The corporate structure is pre-adapted and designed to foster and inflame evil and make it normal. Its hierarchy allows evil to be concentrated at the very top of the system and from there percolate down to everyone in the system. The compartmentalized culture and mindset of corporate employees prevents evil from being detected or opposed. The transfer of all moral judgment and capacity to think for oneself from employees to a higher authority, it's normative in the corporation, but it prevents compassion or values or human moral outrage from impeding evil at any level of the system. Because think about it, we're all saying, well, I can't do anything about it. I'm just a cog in the machine, right? That's the definition of a slave. No ability to take moral and personal responsibility. Now, I hope you're jotting down these things because, like I say, this whole show today is a dialogue sermon. I want you to respond. Write down things. Write your own thoughts. Write me, thecommonland@gmail.com. So anyway, going on with evil, there's only two stable values of a corporation, and that's creating maximum efficiency and perpetuating itself. Be efficient and perpetuate yourself. Those are the two norms of the corporation. Now, that provides a perfect medium in which evil can grow and multiply completely. The proof of all this is found in practice. It's evident in the automatic ease by which even supposedly moral corporations, like churches is supposed to be, can routinely murder, rape, and traffic children, like the Catholic, Anglican, United Churches do right here in Canada. They can murder and traffic children, commit crime, and operate with total impunity and immunity without any cognitive dissonance by its members. Now, cognitive dissonance means your mind goes, whoa, wait a minute, something doesn't work here. What I've been taught isn't true. But that cognitive dissonance doesn't go on. People just blithely go to church. Oh, yeah, children died here in the church, but we're going to give them money anyway. Nobody in a murderous system who's caught up in it is bothered by the murder going on because they do not consider it to be a crime. This understanding is really imperative for any truth teller who does battle with a corporate system, which we all do, whether it's the government, the church, the military, corporations, whoever. Because in a corporation and in a corporate society like ours, there's no other values except one, corporate efficiency and survival. And every normal human value is inverted and subverted to those needs of the corporation. You all have 100 examples of that in your own life, I'm sure. Evil is falsehood incarnate. Jesus identified this when he declared, "The devil is a lie and the father of lies, having no truth within him." Define natural law, which is truth. Natural law is expressed in a normal equality and harmony between all the parts of creation, between all people. But evil twists that falsehood to corrupt and destroy the natural law. Corporations, cultures, individuals can come to embody that lie at every level once they've assimilated the evil into themselves and the lie. Well, in one sense, individual people of the lie are easier to identify than an entire organization of a lie. Because people who are functional psychopaths, they lack any moral correction in their behavior. And yet they exhibit all outward signs of, quote, normalcy. But because they're individuals, they can be corrected by others. You know, the problem is when an institution is evil, everyone goes along with it. So who can correct it? You can only correct it by rebelling against it. And that's something most people have difficulty even imagining. At a corporate level, the disconnect between an individual's sense of morality and the needs of corporations or societies is absolute. Truth is simply a tool that serves a corporate collectivity. And any adversary you have is no different. If you take on an adversary like a big corporation, you'll encounter that fact in a big way once your own actions bring down the wrath of that corporation on you, whether it's a former employee, if you're a whistleblower, or just an ordinary person saying no to Health Canada or the government or whoever. Now, the adversary's official account of you and the wrongs you're exposing will vary according to their need to buttress their own version of events and attack yours. Their lawyers and spin doctors will continually move the goalposts of reality to portray you, their critic, as a chronic malcontent or incompetent or crazy. As we have noted, that kind of lie makes it essential for you to keep an accurate and daily account of events as they happen, as a counterweight to their official lies, and as evidence, say, in future lawsuits. In other words, you have to learn to always cut to the essential thing, to summarize the problem on your terms and not on theirs. and present it in a concise way to the public who don't have any idea what you've been going through, what you've exposed. Well, part of the difficulty any truth teller faces when trying to do that is that there's a general will to disbelieve that's so entrenched that people will automatically believe a powerful corporation or institution. Even if the guilt is written all over them, then they will, one truth-telling individual. It's about numbers in their mind. That's especially the case since the powerful are very adept when it comes to concealing their own wrongdoing. They rely on people's disbelief that those at the top of society can actually constitute a criminal conspiracy. It throws our whole world into disarray because we've been taught to believe in the parental figure, that they're just taking care of us. Well, I like a quote from Saul Alinsky. He was a community organizer in Chicago. And it's strange because for some reason, the neoconservatives have this hysteria when it comes to Saul Alinsky. And, you know, like it's crazy because he was a very effective community organizer and taught poor people how they could win. And that's probably why the neocons who are backed by big money don't like him. But anyway, here's what Saul Alinsky had to say. Anyone can see through a lie unless he has need of that lie. Remember that. Anyone can see through a lie unless he has need of that lie. And everything you've ever been taught about how society runs is a lie that only serves the interests of a wealthy and invisible few. Your job as a truth teller is to help people think, which begins by helping them realize that their own minds have betrayed them because they're not their own, but they belong to the minds of other people in which they've been trapped. I remember that on the streets of Toronto. I met a homeless guy, and I asked him what he was doing there, something about his life. He said, oh yeah, I used to make $80,000 as a cameraman for City TV, but I left it all to live out here. And I said, really? So why? He said, because I was becoming a prisoner in somebody else's mind. And this is what Solinsky's talking about. He goes on, people will break out from that trap only by getting kicked in the teeth enough times by the system and having the courage and clarity to learn for themselves what's really going on, and to know for themselves what's really true and false. That's not something that can be taught to them by anything but their own experience and their ability to understand and own that experience. All right, well, you know, this is maybe common sense, but the point is that in the work we do, we're going to be hit with the big lie all the time. You know, we're going to be told that we're conspiracy theorists, that the Republic of Canada is just somebody's idea, that it's not a reality. It's the same kind of garbage that hit our campaign to expose genocide, but it didn't stop the walls from tumbling down. Smear campaigns don't work over the long run. They help us because they bring more exposure to us. Don't forget that. But here's a big point. Any lie is broken down not by education or teaching people in the abstract, but by constituting a threat to the power of whatever it is behind that lie. That is, you don't break down a lie just by talking. You break it down by getting the big adversary to expose themselves. And classic example I love to show this is right after I was fired by the United Church for bringing out their crimes of residential schools and their land deals where they were grabbing native land and selling it to their business friends like McMillan, Bloedel, and Weyerhaeuser or logging companies. We had a picket outside the United Church conference office in Vancouver in December 1995. And that's where Harry Mahaney, the eyewitnesses to killing at the residential school, showed up. She said, to reporters that she had actually seen a killing in a residential school, and then that opened the floodgates to a lot that followed about the residential school crimes. But anyway, when the news of what we did hit the press, the United Church head office in Toronto issued a press release. And it said, you know, when Harriet was describing the murder of Maisie Shaw by Principal Alfred Cobalt, the United Church press release said, we have no knowledge of such a crime. And we made no attempt to cover it up. Now, in their haste, they totally contradicted themselves. Well, if you have no knowledge of the crime, how could you have covered it up or not covered it up? So by doing that, they exposed themselves right there. They did more than we could do. We provoked them to expose themselves in a big lie. Obviously, and I remember a reporter laughing about it, saying, well, that's their way of saying, yes, we did it. And sure enough, later, that all came out. Yes, it happened. Half the children died. Church was only saved by the government. They're accomplice in crime. That's the only reason they didn't go to jail, because the perpetrators are still in power. But the point is, we provoke them to expose themselves, and that's the way you do it. Mark Twain has a saying, a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes. And the next part I want to talk about is what happens when we confront that lie successfully? Well, then they go on the warpath. They try to wipe us out. They try to erase you, like they've very successfully erased me for a long time, but of course I'm not staying erased all the time. That's most of my life is engaged in struggling out from under that. But they use classic and basic techniques of character assassination. And I like this quote from Proverbs, "With his mouth, the godless man destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge, the righteous will be delivered." Now, they're going to create a straw man account of you right from the beginning. Whatever work you do, I don't mean just you as an individual, but say your common law assembly group, they're going to start circulating lies about you right away. But follow Sun Tzu's basic point, which is you set the terms of battle and then they have to respond. You don't respond to what they're saying. They say it's a COVID virus, and so all of you are obsessed with the so-called COVID virus and all the nefarious things. But no, that's to respond to their terms, on their terms of battle. You say, no, this is about a police state. Let's talk about the police state being imposed. And then you shift the energy. You start taking back your chi energy. And so they cannot destroy you unless you cooperate in that destruction. They use a method that I call the three Ds: distraction, discrediting, and destruction. And Peter Montague, who I mentioned earlier, that guy who was involved with the Nazi doctors, he was referring to our presidential school tribunal in 1998, and he said, first we fog them, then we blacken them, then we wipe them out. That's his technique of discrediting a movement. And the first thing is distraction. You got to think for a moment like your adversary does. And the first thing they want to do is if you expose a crime, they don't want the limelight on that crime. So they redirect, like a lawyer does in court. They redirect all the way, all the time, onto the issue they want to talk about. So, for example, right after I exposed that crime at our press conference where Harry Nahanny spoke and it hit the newspaper, guess what happened within a week of that? The United Church issues a press statement that I am facing permanent defrocking. And they let all these other suggestions out that, you know, I was unstable and I had to be removed from good of my congregation, even though there were the pews were filled to the day I was canned. And so what they do is they immediately released in the press the fact that you got to kind of doubt this Kevin Anna because he's been under investigation for a while. So what they did there is they redirected away from the issue of their own crime onto me. They controversialized me, which is what black ops operations do all the time. They target an individual, make him the issue rather than the crime. It's like in law school, they taught me, if the evidence is on your side, you argue the evidence in court. If the evidence is against you, you attack the witnesses. And that's exactly what they do all the time. It's designed to distract. Discredit is more obvious. They start the smear campaigns. They pay people, you know, to say, oh, we used to work with Kevin Anna, but then we saw the truth about him. Now, you might search on the internet. You'll find people like that. And the way it works is they're usually women, because that way there can be the suggestion that Kevin was sexually harassing people. But two or three different women showed up right at the height of our campaign, where Ratzinger was about to resign. Suddenly these women show up who said, oh, Kevin was harassing me over Skype, and he was, you know, doing all these nefarious things. I can't remember the extent of the smear, but these were people I'd never met. I had had Skype conversations with once or twice, and who I was actually helping, you know, in their community to organize things. Suddenly they turn against me, because it's much better to have somebody who appears to have been your supporter turn in on you than just Joe Blow. But again, it wasn't done very well, because anyone with a bit of research could see that these people barely knew me, had never met me, and it was all bogus. So I can't really believe that these campaigns against us are very sophisticated. They don't seem to be that professional. And I learned that with the church. They tend to react, shoot from the hip, and react in a very, you know, unclear and confused way, because they're in panic. Don't forget, they've got their backs to the wall. So discrediting doesn't work if you keep your facts together, you keep your head, and you don't act out of emotion and start calling names. Here's a few basic things, do's and don'ts. Never make a statement that you can't back up with evidence and proof. Never, ever engage in name-calling, obscenities, personal attacks, or incitements to physical violence. Do not be provoked into angry, impulsive remarks. Do not have anyone else speak on your behalf or speak in the name of your efforts without first approving what they say. Do not associate with unstable individuals with their own axes or causes to grind, because you'll be found guilty by association. Do not accept money or endorsements from people in groups you don't know. And do not walk into obvious setups or entrapments, especially financial or sexual ones. In other words, folks, don't be stupid when you take on the adversary. And we've got about 3 minutes left. Time goes quickly on this show. But next week, I'm going to continue on. We're reading out of this manual because it's very practical lessons, and it's meant for the people out there in these common law assemblies, because you're moving from the stage of talk to action. And these are very practical questions. Like I say, get the manual. It's on Amazon. Truth Teller's Shield, a manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers. Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. That's my name. Don't wear it out. Final stage, destruction. Yes, they can possibly kill you, but they're not going to because they don't want to create a martyr, especially if you're somebody with a pale skin. The Indians, they can get rid of, no problem in Canada. It's legal to do so and safe to do so, but we've got protection if we're not Native, and we can use that to our advantage. And I want to go into that in more detail, especially something called COINTELPRO, which was the FBI operation to wipe out numerous groups in America, including the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement. And they used a method called bad jacketing, which you target the best activists and you put a bad jacket around them. You make them seem evil. You get people to start shooting at each other, literally, in paranoia. So you don't fight that with fire. You don't counterattack each other and try to hunt out who the cop is. You can never find a very good operative who's involved in your group. I just say put them to work, give them false information. Meantime, keep the high ground, stick on the issues, don't attack personalities. And that's the policy and practice that I've followed over the years, to not do that. I'm going to leave it at that, partly because my voice is giving out. And I hope you've liked the fireside chat today, and I hope you'll write to me with your comments, anything you've heard today. That's thecommonland@gmail.com. I need you all to check out our website, murderbydecree.com. And especially in the coming weeks, stay tuned for more news about common law assemblies. They're really taking on a whole life of their own. People are realizing all over the place that we can't look to any political leader, whatever stripe, whoever you believe in, who may seem to be in power, do not trust them. Trust only your abilities, what you can do in your community. Don't think in terms of a big constitution or national conventions. Do what you can in your own community. We build a new republic, the common law republic, from the grassroots upwards. That way we control it. We're our own leaders. We're going to end on a good song, and it's from the civil rights movement. It's pretty self-explanatory. Until next week, folks, stay strong, stay clear. Do not give in. Do not give up. This is Eagle Strong Voice Kevin Annett. I thank you.